Show yourself. Let me see you as you truly are.
No,
Hiroshima.
Well, hello, Jellyheads, and welcome to another exciting episode of Know Your Turn Set to Drive In. I'm your host, Dave, with my friend and co-host,
It.
You're It?
The Thing.
Would that be the terror from beyond space?
An alien. Luke.
All right, there we go. Alien Luke is with us today.
Yes, I'm here. Hey, guys.
I mean, if we had to go through like a list of like movie titles that had It, or, I mean, there's of course the movie It that just came out last year, the Stephen King adaptation. And we're going to get a sequel to that soon, right?
Yeah, I think they're going to do a version with their adults. And they come back.
You know, basically part two of Stephen King's novel.
Well, it wasn't really a part two, is it? Isn't it just like it goes back and forth?
I don't know. I haven't read the book, actually. That's entirely possible. I know the TV movie did a part one and a part two. It did like part one when they were kids and part two when they were older.
I think I read when that was out. The book is like it goes back and forth between timelines.
Hmm.
So like it's kind of like the kid parts are like flashbacks.
Okay. I'm sure Stephen King had his reasons, but for movie purposes, I think what they're doing with this probably makes a lot more sense.
Sure.
Just in terms of cinematically. And really, It has become the like definitive horror film lately.
I thought it was okay. I wasn't...
Right. Yeah, there's mixed opinions about it. That's not what I'm talking about. But it's become the definitive horror film right now.
Hmm. Sure.
It's like when people are talking about horror films, like referencing them, like say they're on Facebook and they're referencing a horror film, it's It that gets brought up. It's like the go-to reference for horror films right now.
Would you say maybe like Paranormal Activity was the last reigning king?
Oh, Paranormal Activity or Sinister, maybe?
Now, I feel like Paranormal because they spawned like 30 sequels.
Yeah, Sinister had its fan base, but it didn't like have this like popular consciousness the way that something like Paranormal Activity.
And then before that, maybe the Saw series.
Yeah, it would have to be the Saw series. We're not saying that these are the best horror films that came out, and I would strongly say that they're not the best horror films that came out in their time. But they're the ones that the public knows best.
And then before Saw, the Blair Witch.
Sure.
Before the Blair Witch.
Silence of the Lambs. Was that what you were going to say?
No.
What were you going to say?
I feel like maybe all like the old the 80s slashers are probably still in consciousness, but in the conscience.
I would say 90s primary horror movie reference is Silence of the Lambs.
Hmm. Is that a horror movie?
I would call it a thriller, but I mean when there are elements of that go straight to horror.
Sure.
Like when Lecter escapes and he kills those guards, that's a horror movie scene.
But we didn't watch a horror movie, Dave.
No, we did not. But
there were some horrified people in this. But
yes, for sure. But I have to say about the movie It and why people are and why it was so successful is it had the most brilliant marketing campaign. Like, seriously, I have not seen a marketing campaign that effective in a few years.
What do you mean? Why was it so good?
Like, The Dark Tower came out the same year, right? It's another Stephen King story. Try explaining what The Dark Tower is in a trailer. It doesn't work. Watch those trailers. They make no freaking sense. It doesn't convey to an audience what this is about. Here's what you have to understand about It. Scary clown. It's a scary clown movie. That's all you need to understand. It's so dead goddamn simple that they were able to market it brilliantly. That red balloon was everywhere. Everyone was talking about it. And there were parody t-shirts with like Simpsons characters that were being sold before the movie came out. That was the most brilliant marketing I've witnessed in a long time, and I applaud the marketing of the movie It because it was so effective.
I wonder, with Dark Tower, they probably should have in the marketing maybe focused on like one portion of the movie.
They should have just focused on the character of Roland. That's it. Forget everything else. Focused on the character of Roland and hint at the Man in Black.
Yeah, him hunting that guy down. Instead of been talking, you don't need to do the world building in the trailer.
That's the worst place to do world building.
Like, you just, yeah, you have him chasing that guy down. Like, you can easily make a trailer out of that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember right now the trailers for Lord of the Rings, but, like, Lord of the Rings, it's like you show fantasy stuff, you know? You show guys with swords, elves, and some cool special effects, and people are like, okay, I know what that is. I recognize it. Fantasy has been around for generations, so you make a trailer for Lord of the Rings, people go, okay, I have a general idea about what that is. Something like the Dark Tower? their trailer was just like, what is this movie about? It was showing different timelines and all this. I think it would have been to that movie's benefit if they were more deceptive with their advertising. Not necessarily revealing the whole scope of the film, but, and I don't even know if it's a good film. I did not watch it. So it might just be a shit film. That's why
Kevin,
I know,
Kevin might be the guy to ask for that, because he's a King fan, and he may have seen the movie, because I saw It with him.
Okay.
But I think he's seen it and agrees that it's not a very good film. He and Lucas were having a discussion about how that movie just, like, I don't know, it truncated things way too much. It was just...
I've heard that. I've heard it's like, imagine taking the Harry Potter series and trying to do the first three books in one movie.
Yeah. Yeah. But he has said he's read every book that's related to the Dark Tower series.
So not just the series, but the other books and short stories.
Yeah, which like would include like It as well.
That's true, sadly. I think the priest from Salem's Lot shows up in the Dark Tower at one point.
Yeah. Well, then you get a part in Dark Tower where Stephen King is like a main character.
Yeah, but it was like with the Dark Tower, you're saying it's a bad movie. The quality of a movie doesn't determine what puts asses in seats. It's like it literally is marketing.
Yes, it's rare that that's not the case.
There are some great exceptions to that rule, of course.
So how does this tie back into our?
It doesn't. I don't know why I wanted to have a long-winded rant, and I had it.
Do you really not want to talk about It Came From Outer Space, Dave?
No, let's talk about It Came From Outer Space, Lucas.
Yes, it came from outer space to fill the world with terror, to bring you unforgettable suspense. What was it? Where did it come from? Who were the all-powerful creatures it brought from outer space? And what did they want on Earth? You can learn the amazing answer only when you see the most thrilling picture in years. It Came From Outer Space.
You know what, Dave? The aliens in this movie actually were kind of scary.
Yeah. How so?
It's not like the eyeball might be a little bit on like the cheesier side, but it's like this monstrous, like a... evil caterpillar. It's not a gray or your typical or just a man in a tinfoil suit or a stiff-armed robot looking alien thing. This is just this horrifying beast.
There's an element of it that it's kind of amorphous. It's kind of blobular. It likes there's parts of it that don't quite make sense, and it sort of feels like you're looking at an illusion, but it's also a puppet at the same time. So even though they show it, like, they just show it coming out of the shadows, I still feel like I don't have a complete picture of what this alien looks like.
Yeah, they don't ever linger on it, which is great. They give you enough time, like, it's like somebody sitting there with a stopwatch for, like, the right moment to cut away. So that you don't start examining the prop. So you get there enough for your brain to go like, whoa, what the hell is that? And just as you're starting to make sense of it, they cut away and they keep to the main character or a POV of the alien.
Which was also funny. I heard that the POV was like them actually having like a bubble in front of the camera lens.
Sure, I can believe
that. And they had to kind of keep those shots short because the bubble would burst.
Okay, that's a clever way to do that.
But it's doing what you're supposed to do to create a sense of tension, a sense of suspense, which is not necessarily you don't show the monster. You show what the monster does, show evidence of the monster. That trail of glitter that it leaves behind, it's just like, that's just weird.
Hey, it gives you a lot of mystery. And there's a moment when he confronts one of these aliens in the mine, in this mine shaft, because at some point they kidnap a bunch of humans to keep them hostage, and they're hiding out in a mine shaft. But the guy greets one at the shaft to talk to him, and it's just talking to him through this black void in the mountain.
Yeah, it just shows the entrance to the mine shaft that just goes into darkness.
Yeah, and they just talk to each other, and he's like, "I want to see you." And the alien keeps going, "It's like, you don't want to see me. I'm horrifying." And finally, he's like, the alien relents. And I was a little disappointed that they were going to show him, because I thought that was a neat trick. But even still, the alien like doesn't come out in full sunlight. It just starts emerging out of this inky blackness towards him, and the guy just like covers his eyes. And it was like, oh, that was good.
It focuses on his reaction more than it focuses on the monster, which is how you create horror, how you create suspense.
So like you saw it come out, and it was very creepy the way it came out. But it didn't come and stand out in the harsh sunlight so you could examine this thing. It was, yeah.
Now, let's, for the audience, say a bit of a summary of this movie. Starts out, meteorite crashes to Earth. The scientist and his girlfriend go out to, like, say, all right, he's a scientist. He's got to go check this thing out. It's like, a meteor landed. He goes down there, and he gets down into the crater, and there's this opening in, like, a cave-like opening at the bottom of the crater, and he sees a ship, and he's like, what the frick is this? You know, it's great. He's just like, whoa. Then a rock slide covers it up.
He sees an alien in the thing too.
He sees a door close. He sees something of the alien.
And then you see from the alien's point of view as the door closes.
But yeah, there's this rock slide leading to a bulk of the film where he's trying to convince everyone that he saw a spaceship.
This is almost like a movie showing the last movie we watched how to do this better.
That is a good point. Although, I think every movie in existence is showing that movie how to do things better.
But I mean, like it there's just like some little bits of it that like seem similar. Like they both start out as like this couple in a car, right?
Well, this starts out a couple at a house.
Oh, they're at the house. Why did I think they were in a car?
Because they're in a car a lot of this movie. There's a lot of car stuff for some reason in this movie, which was actually one of the attractions of this movie. It was just like it's kind of neat looking at these old cars.
Yeah, it is kind of neat. But yeah, I don't know. You got this. They're both like an astronomer or something like that with a lady friend.
Lady friend.
Aliens arrive. In one, they're just, you don't know what the fuck is going on with these aliens. They're just zipping around. The guy is being so clinical about it. And then you got this other dude who kind of almost has like this, he's like the same job, but he's way more curious about it. He doesn't have all the answers.
You're talking about the guy in this movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, the guy in this movie is he's immediately like, again, he's in this place where he's trying to convince everybody of it. There's two things I want to point out about the tone of this movie. One is this movie started out as Ray Bradbury wrote a script, basically.
Mm-hmm.
He handed it off to a studio saying, look at my script. They paid him off to take the script and handed it to a screenwriter to polish up. The screenwriter who polished it up and gets the screenwriting credit, whereas Ray Bradbury only gets story credit, actually said to Ray Bradbury, it's like, you gave me an easy job, dude. Like, I barely had to work for this thing. So it's really a Ray Bradbury script. And then the second thing I want to point out is that this feels exactly the way an episode of The X-Files feels, where you have this main character who's trying to get other people to, like, okay, here's the evidence. Here's what I'm... do you believe that I'm... my conclusion that it's aliens, you know?
No, he's not saying it's aliens.
But it's aliens, yes.
It's actually the opposite of that. He's saying it's aliens, but it's not aliens.
Oh, that's a good way to like a trope of an X-Files episode where it's like he's saying it's aliens, but it's not aliens. But here it's aliens.
Not according to this sheriff guy. Although I'll say his actions sometimes feel like almost irrationally, I gotta kill.
The sheriff?
Yeah.
One of the things I like about this movie is it feels like everybody in this movie has a backstory. Like, these people existed before this movie began. And that's actually a really cool thing that, like, not the greatest proportion of movies achieve. Like, there's clearly this history between the astronomer, his girlfriend, and the sheriff. The girlfriend was obviously prior a girlfriend of the sheriff. Or at least, that's what the sheriff wanted. Whether they actually dated or anything, it's clear that the sheriff was at least at one point infatuated and still is. And that's where his jealousy and his prejudice against this astronomer comes from. It's like immediately clear with his character introduction that that relationship is the backstory.
I can relate. I think a lot of us can relate. I don't like you because you're with that girl I like.
It's true. But yeah, it's a real human motivation.
Yeah, it had me thinking a little bit about how when, like in films, like you kind of like end up going like to this guy like, come on, get over it. Like, what is the thing? But then like you really got to think about yourself and like your own actions and how you feel. And sometimes like it's like this guy's going a little too far where he's going like, I got to kill all these aliens. But
resist that. Actually, I kind of feel differently about you, because as the plot goes along, it's like right in the beginning, obviously no one believes the astronomer that he saw a spaceship.
No, for like most of the movie.
But the second weird stuff goes on, the sheriff goes, all right, I'm willing to listen to you. What do you think's going on? But as the astronomer starts to explain his theories about what's going on, he's like, I'm trying to stay with you, but you can't expect me to buy all that, you know? Which is totally a fair thing to do. You never really get that point in so many movies. They go from disbelief to belief. This is a more interesting development than most movies actually have, where the person's like, it's either like, okay, there's no such thing as vampires, or, oh my God, we gotta put a stake through this thing's heart. This is a guy going, maybe I'm willing to listen to this because I can't come up with a better explanation of what's happening, but I don't fully believe yet. And that's an interesting place to put a character in. And also a character that's at odds with the protagonist. And of course, at the beginning when no one believes him, it's like the newspapers are making fun of him. Other scientists are denying what he's saying is possible. You know, so it's like this guy's got an uphill battle to get people to believe him. And then when the sheriff finally does believe him, he doesn't necessarily know what to do with it. He wants to fight it. That's his first instinct. It's like, there's this thing. It's shown that it's dangerous because it's kidnapping people. So my job as a sheriff is to protect those people. So I have to confront this thing. And the scientist convinces him for a time that he's like, no, these are aliens. These came from outer space in a spaceship that is so far beyond anything we know anything about. They're telling us that they're not threatening. So it's kind of in our best interest to believe them. It's kind of like a hostage situation. I mean, it is a hostage situation where it's like, okay, if we break down the front door, there's a good chance that the hostage takers are going to kill the hostages. So this small town sheriff really doesn't know what to do. But the longer he holds off, the more resistance he has from like his deputies and people in the town. It doesn't go into too much detail on that, but you know it's there. From at least one scene, they show that that's happening, where it's like they want something done, you know? And they're pressuring him to take action. And after a fist fight with the astronomer, he decides he has to take action. So I don't think it's like, I gotta kill these aliens crazy. The aliens kidnap the girlfriend, you know, which drives both of these characters crazy in different ways, you know? I mean, that's how I saw it. Like, you have the astronomer who's obsessed with, I have to protect the aliens because through protecting the aliens, I'm protecting my girlfriend. And you have the sheriff going, I have to kill the aliens to save my would-be girlfriend. So you literally got that situation where it's like, these two guys want to solve the same problem, but they have differences of opinion about how what is best to do that. It's almost like a philosophical difference about what is best to do that.
Sure, I'll go along with that.
And I think there are some real-world connotations. Like, this came out during the Cold War. I think there are some real-world connotations to what these two characters are representing. You know, it's like, this is how we deal with this problem. No, this is how we should deal with this problem, you know? You can relate to that today. Just like, take any subject that's a social subject and you can, in the political discourse that goes on around it, this problem can be seen as related to that.
You make some good points, Dave.
All right, I hope I did. But yeah, let's get to talking about the aliens, because this is really interesting about the aliens in this film. They're not invaders, and they're not here to make peace. They're here by accident, and they want to get away. They don't want to interact with humanity. They don't want to have a positive or negative interaction with humanity. They don't want to interact with humanity.
Yeah, they said they were on their way to a different planet, but something happened, and they crashed here.
That is an interesting motive for the aliens. Now, for the bulk of the film, you don't know what the motive of the aliens is, and that creates a lot of mystery and suspense. You could even say that the plot of this movie revolves around unknown motivations. That's what drives the plot forward, is trying to find out why these aliens are here, you know, and why they're doing what they're doing. It's like, that's what, for the bulk of the movie, right up to the climactic scene is what the main character is trying to figure out. And I particularly love the scene in this film that I call the Shining scene.
Oh, the two guys standing?
Yeah.
In the hallway? Alley? Or hallway?
They go into an alleyway, and then they go into a door through that alleyway, and the doctor opens up the door, and they're just standing there in this hallway, like the Shining girls. Just completely in shadow, backlit. There's some light source down there, but yeah, it's like, and they're saying, just leave us alone. We're not here to harm you. We just need to do what we need to do, and we won't hurt anyone. And again, it's this question, it's like, but they're not explaining their motivations. They're just saying, we don't need to explain our motivations. Just leave us alone. To this point where it's like, the main character has to decide whether or not he's going to trust these aliens. And he's on this philosophical point that he's like, we have to trust the aliens because that's what's in the best interest of saving the people they've taken hostage. And till he like goes in, and they actually try to kill him. The aliens actually do try to kill him because he won't just go away and let them work. He keeps investigating. So they actually try to kill him off, at which point he does kill one of the aliens, which the guy who is kill alien crazy never actually kills an alien. Our protagonist, who's like, trust the aliens, does kill an alien.
What about they shot up that truck.
Oh, that's right. They do shoot up that one truck. Okay, so they're one for one. They both got an alien kill. I did forget about that scene for a moment.
But he killed an alien that was just trying to get away, while the doctor killed an alien that was trying to shoot at him.
Yeah. That was neat. She hit the alien that was impersonating his girlfriend at the time, who also, for some reason, felt that the girlfriend wasn't wearing a sexy enough outfit. So created a new outfit for her that was like more revealing, which is hilarious.
Trying to remember when I saw her in that scene. It's like, was she wearing that?
No, she never wears that outfit as herself. Only as the alien impersonating her does she wear that black dress.
She tried to get that guy to step off a ledge and fall to his death in a pit. He doesn't fall for that. So she takes out like a magic wand.
Yeah, basically what looks like a magic wand.
And shoots at him. But like she clearly has a beam that shows exactly where everything's going. So the fact that she missed is...
These aliens have one eye.
They have really bad depth perception.
Really bad depth perception. Yeah, I'm going to go with that. I'm going to go with that explanation. Yeah, have you we get to see their jelly vision all the time. So it's kind of like, there, just really bad depth perception for these aliens.
You can also see maybe like she then decides to just, it's like a warning shot, but then like he just kills her, so.
Oh, that's another thing. Was like, was it meant to kill him or was it meant to scare him away? And he just reacted in self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
But I like depth perception better. It's funnier.
I can't see!
This alien that just wanted to feel pretty, but had poor depth perception and couldn't shoot the magic wand where it wanted to. And you gotta think, it's like this alien is creating an illusion. So it's like whatever weapon it has on it, it's interpreting through its illusion this magic wand. Like, logically, if everything else this movie is shown as follows, that's what's happening.
What about the illusion with the magic wand?
Like, there's this jelly alien that's creating the illusion that it's this woman standing there.
Right.
And the magic wand is part of the illusion. So whatever, like, weapon...
Because it doesn't have arms?
Again, yeah, it's just... It's like a jellyfish. It doesn't have arms. So it's like, is this an organic weapon? Is it a technological weapon that it built? Whatever it is, it's interpreting through this illusion that it's a magic wand. That's what's happening, right?
Now, why did the aliens, when the doctor stumbled upon them working on the ship, did they all look human? They didn't know he was there, specifically at that point. That one dude, that one alien was very shocked when the guy came in with a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Why were they human?
Yeah, and they. Why do they need to... capture humans and impersonate them? It makes sense that they needed to get into town, but they really only do that with two guys. The rest they impersonate while they're working on their ship, which seems to suggest to me that they don't have a lot of their own dexterity. You know, like you said, they have no arms, but taking the form of these humans to work on their ship is, maybe it's not just an illusion, maybe it's like a shapeshifting.
Yeah, that might make more sense. So there isn't, because then again, like, how do these aliens make this technology with no appendages?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many good questions, and this film doesn't have answers, and yet it doesn't feel like it's a mistake. It just feels like it's a level of weirdness. Like, if this was the aliens in the last movie, they would have explained just have been a guy sitting there explaining exactly how they have to fix their ship, why they're taking people hostage to do it, and stuff. But this film doesn't explain it. It's just, I know for a movie reason is that it makes more sense that he comes across a bunch of people working on the ship rather than a bunch of aliens, because you probably only have one alien costume. So there's just the practical reason of the filmmakers doing that. But they've done such an effective job of getting us to suspend our disbelief that our first motivation is to think, now, why are the aliens doing it this way? Not, oh, the filmmakers just had one costume, so they're just being lazy. But it actually is more interesting this way, because the leader of the aliens has taken on the form of the astronomer.
Yeah, that's an interesting...
So you have him having this confrontational conversation with himself.
Can you imagine that? Like, alien can't, you know, properly talk to you in its form, or at least it doesn't think you're going to be able to handle it, so it chooses to be you.
Hmm. Oh, that is another point. The hostages were around, so maybe they were in human form for the sake of the hostages.
Hmm.
Hmm?
That's true.
Yes. See, this is why it's a good science fiction movie, because we think about the characters' motivations rather than why the filmmakers did something. We're invested, man. But yeah, the whole stolen identity thing, which they play on a lot, like, that's a big part of this movie. And obviously, this came out before Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and Invasion of the Body Snatchers took that concept to its next level.
Yeah, this is It shares a lot of DNA with that movie regarding this concept.
But what Invasion Body Snatchers doesn't have is the character confronting themselves in an alien form, which is a really cool climactic scene. It's like, this movie, like, its plot structure, it didn't, like, fall apart, you know what I mean? Or it didn't have this obvious peak at the beginning, and then it was just like, well, the concept plays out. I wouldn't say that the narrative is surprising at any point, but the drama builds to a good and satisfying place.
It doesn't flatten out like Earth versus the Flying Saucer, where you had like the opening conflict, then nothing.
Or even I would say the Day the Earth Stood Still has this like opening, and then it's like sort of treading until the end.
A little bit.
This has a good building action where it's like, okay, this is the next part of it. This is the next part. There's a lot of good scenes in it, and they're paced out. And like you said, just like it's showing the alien emerging out of that inky blackness, it shows you just enough and then it cuts away. Every scene in this film makes sense and it all builds, and it none of them feel like they drag out. This is a pretty, you know, effective film in that sense. But again, I gotta bring it back to that stolen identity. It's like this film is playing on a lot of different tropes that we see repeatedly throughout science fiction. One of which we've already talked about is the no one believes me element, and that convincing people as things get weirder and weirder, things happen, and other people see that things are happening. It's just like, it's to that point where it's like, are we going to believe this guy, right? That's, you see that all over the place. And that's always interesting. Now, as most films play as this does, where it's like that concept is that you know what the protagonist knows. So you're like looking at the characters going, you got to believe him. Come on. He knows what he's talking about. You got to believe him. But some films have played the other side of that, where it's like, you're as the audience aren't sure whether or not to believe the person.
But we saw the Flying Saucer.
Right, yeah, this one is playing that way. But still, like him, we don't know what the alien motivation is. Now, if we did know what the alien's motivations were, and I guess if you're watching this for a second time, you do, then that does change the story. But first time viewing, you're as mystified by the aliens as he is, and it adds to the drama and the suspense. You believe him that there's aliens, but there's an element that where throughout the story, you can question what the motivation of the aliens is, and you can either fall on his side, the astronomer's side, or the sheriff's side, really. You know, you could be watching this thinking, man, don't trust these aliens. You gotta go in there and you gotta fight them.
Right. What sets this... it's like I'm going back to Flying Saucer, right?
Okay.
In that, we also don't really know what the aliens' motivation is.
But in that, they don't create enough intrigue. We have no investment in the characters. There's no sense of stakes,
like,
really.
Like, what's how does that fail at the stakes that this achieves?
Well, first of all, the writing's good. And the acting's decent. Like, this feels like an episode of The Twilight Zone, where it's like, yeah, I believe these characters right now. What they're doing makes, like, what our protagonists are doing makes sense. How people are reacting to our protagonists makes sense. Whereas, like, Earth versus the Flying Saucer, or any science fiction film where you see a bunch of guys in suits sitting around a table going, well, so should we believe the aliens? Here's how we should fight the aliens if we decide to fight the aliens. It's like, that's probably a bad movie. Anytime you see guys in suits sitting around the table discussing what to do about a problem in a movie, and it's a science fiction movie, you're probably watching a bad movie. 9 times out of 10. Seriously. This has significant sequences. You're in a location that they really, that which is the Mojave Desert. They call it, dry sands or something? Sand rock. It's supposed to be Arizona. It's the Mojave Desert. And you have a guy, you know, looking at it, it's like talking about like, the desert can play tricks on you. They see a Joshua tree and they mistake it for an alien at one point. It's like a strong sense of setting. Again, think about episodes of The X-Files. They go to a place, you know, and they maybe it's like the episode where they're up in that I don't know where they were, in some cold climate. I don't know if it was the Arctic or something, or Alaska or something. But with that, the Thing episode, you know what I mean? From season one.
Mm-hmm.
And like a strong sense of setting helps the audience invest themselves, right, in the stakes of like, whereas like Earth versus the Flying Saucer cutting all over the place. You know, it's like we can't care about this thing getting destroyed over here because we're going to cut 2 seconds later to another part of the country where something else is being destroyed, you know.
Keep it to these characters.
It feels like a more isolated incident. And by making it a more isolated incident, the stakes feel more personal. And we feel more invested in the smaller details. It's like this is happening to one town. It's, and again, War of the Worlds does this effectively by setting that up as the beginning of its story, where it starts happening in one place, you know. You have the Yoka locals.
The Loki Yokis.
Who are checking out the meteorite and get vaporized. Because if you live in a town, you can say, okay, what if this was my town? You can connect. Where does Earth versus the Flying Saucers take place? It's a military base. I haven't spent a lot of time hanging around a military base with rocket scientists hanging around. That's not an environment that's familiar to me. Why should I care if it gets blown up? In a movie, at least. In real life, if something blew up a military base, you'd be very concerned. And again, it shows us these characters before something happens to them. It's not like a bunch of guys run up, get vaporized. You know, like we see in War of the Worlds, we see the priest who then goes out to try to confront the aliens. As he's saying a prayer, and it's like not a prayer, but like he's saying verses from the Bible as he walks towards the spaceship and then gets vaporized. It's like we can feel something because we know that this character has a motivation. He's made a decision, you know, that which is very character building. It's like if you have a character on screen making decisions, we can connect to that. You know, it's like, okay, making a decision has a point of view. Am I rambling too much?
No, Dave, you're good.
And we also know that the priest is related to the main character. So there we care about how, you know, when he gets vaporized, it cuts immediately to that actress who's overacting. But and that immediately distracts you from whatever, you know, emotional depth the priest getting vaporized gave you. All of a sudden you're laughing at this overacting actress. But still, we were able to connect. Like, here, we see all the players. You know, we meet these two guys, and they have distinct personalities. Like, that guy up on the telephone pole, he's a character. He's somebody, like, you might run into in real life. Of course, here he's waxing poetic about the desert, which...
every layman seems to be doing that in this film.
Yeah, the townies are very poetic. Like, even the sheriff has this moment where he says this line. Here, I'll just read it because it's right in front of me. Did you know, Putnam, more people are murdered at 92 degree Fahrenheit than any other temperature? I read an article once. Lower temperatures, people are easygoing. Over 92, it's too hot to move. But just 92, people get irritable. It's like somebody saying something like that makes you feel like they're not some walk-by, you know, background character. They exist in a world. It's like, I read an article, and I have an opinion about something. It, you know, that is saying that this character exists. Like, I don't know how else to put it. It's like these subtle details are the clay of the suspension of disbelief. And a film like Earth versus the Flying Saucers has none of them. This, it's like we meet the guy fixing the telephone wire, and then the alien shows up and possesses him, and we notice that there's a difference in his personality when it's the alien. If we didn't have an impression of what his personality was like before, seeing him as the alien, or seeing the alien impersonating him, wouldn't be effective. It wouldn't work. And we've been saying about all this about why we care about the characters. But another thing is, the more you get to see the aliens, the more you actually start to see the aliens as characters themselves. You know, they're saying, just leave us alone. We don't want to hurt you. So you start to sympathize a little bit with the aliens in this movie. They're here by accident. They don't want to be involved. Like you said, they're not here to invade. They're not here to make friends. They're here by accident, and they want to just fix their ship and get away. They're not supposed to. It's like, you're not supposed to see us. They're just really bad at blending in, which is kind of funny.
They did a pretty good job of getting you on the alien side. You know, they weren't... I mean, like, they took people. Not cool, but given how hostile the sheriff was, you kind of came to understand their reasoning.
Yeah, I mean, the protagonist even says to the sheriff, he's like, because the sheriff's like, hey, if they don't have any bad intentions, why don't they just come out and show themselves and be like, hey, we're here. And he's like, and the astronomer's just like, all right, look at that spider on the ground. Do you relate to that?
That spider.
That spider was bad. I wish they hadn't have actually shown the spider. It would have been a more effective scene if you just stayed on them and you didn't show the spider. Like, think about, like, stage work. You point at the ground and say, look, there's a spider there. It's like the audience is too far away to see it.
It was a rubber spider.
It was the rubberest spider.
Just on a string.
Yeah, that was the one groan of the entire movie that I felt, where it's just like, oh, come on. Well, there were other groans, but those involved sexism. So, stay here, woman. I'm going to go run towards danger. So there's that. But again, it's like those two guys fixing the telephone wire, they disappear. Not only do you see them show up in town as these, like, zombie versions of themselves, you also get to see the one guy's wife and the other guy's girlfriend showing up at the sheriff's office going, it wasn't them. Yeah, again, the whole stolen identity premise, like the loved ones, like, saying, there was something weird about them. They weren't acting right, and now they've disappeared. Where are they going? It's like, again, like showing the monster, like making the monster scary, not by showing the monster, but by showing what the monster can do. It's like creating stakes to these characters by showing how it affects people. You know, it's like whether you're showing a character reacting to another character's death. Like, I've noticed that, where it's like, in watching TV shows, movies, where it's like, say, there'll be a scene where a character gets killed, and I'm just like, oh, wow, look at that. They chopped that guy's head right off. Wow. And it's just an action in a scene. But then they show, like, the guy's daughter, right? It's I'm thinking of Game of Thrones, honestly, God. Ned Stark gets his head cut off. I don't feel anything. It's just a scene in a movie, in a TV show. But then they show his daughter in the crowd. Now I feel something. And this film is just on a very basic level. It's not the greatest film in the world, but it is nonetheless very effective in what it does. But there's that other trope that we keep bringing up, the stolen identity trope. And, like, there's that great scene, and it's like, or the sheriff's looking at him. Oh, yeah, the spider scene, or it's like, the sheriff obviously crushes the spider. It's like, what do you do if you see a spider? You kill it. And the sheriff's like, yeah. He's like, exactly. That's why these aliens aren't showing up. Because the second you saw him, you'd try to kill him. It's like saying that it's almost like a human instinctive thing, where it's like something that looks dangerous to us, if it shows up in our house, it's like, ah, ah,
blah, blah.
So yeah, the aliens' fear of humans maybe goes a little too far, where they're trying to kill the astronomer, saying, "Hey, we'll blow you all up. We'll blow ourselves up. We'll," you know. So it's going a little too far, but you can understand the base motivation of it. But yeah, now back to stolen identities. You have another scene where the sheriff and the astronomer are where the astronomer is explaining that they can impersonate people, and the sheriff's like, "That's crazy. If what you're saying is true, I couldn't trust anybody. It's like I couldn't trust that you were you, you know." And the astronomer's just like, "That's right. Wouldn't it be a nice trick if I was actually an alien? I led you out here." It's a really kind of creepy, tense scene, and it's well acted, and it's well shot, and it's like, because the astronomer, as he's saying this, like, walks a little bit into the foreground, leaving the sheriff in the background, kind of looking like, sort of isolated, creating a visual separation of the two. Mm-hmm. It's like they're not standing side by side having this conversation. It's like at the beginning of the conversation, they are standing side by side, as they're going back and forth. He's like, yeah, yeah. But then he starts to put doubt in the sheriff's mind, and they stand apart. You know, they separate physically from each other. And so now they're both sort of isolated, and they're not even, like, he's not looking at the sheriff, but the sheriff's looking at him, right?
Right.
So it's like there's this weird tension to that whole scene. It's like they really thought about how to shoot that and make that creepy and make that work. It's good filming. It's made by Jack Arnold, the same guy who directed Creature from the Black Lagoon and The Incredible Shrinking Man, which are both great science fiction films.
Do they have elements like that?
Definitely in The Incredible Shrinking Man. The Creature of the Black Lagoon is, I've always loved that film. It's a bit more of just a straightforward monster movie, though.
Okay.
But yeah, here it's just the amount, it's like you just start to dissect that scene, that one scene, and there's so much going on, and it's so effective and creepy, and there's no alien in it. It's like, usually, it's like in the monster movie, it's like if something's not happening with the monsters, it's just two guys talking on screen. It's usually boring. Here, it's not. Here, it's actually, they created a tense, scary scene, something like John Carpenter's The Thing, where it's like, are you really you? And again, like we said, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, The Thing, that stolen identity premise, or even the black goo that gets into people in The X-Files and possesses them. Possession movies are another form of stolen identity, you know? It's like, that's something that's creepy. It's always creepy. I've never seen it in a movie or a TV show where it wasn't creepy, where someone's not who they're supposed to be. Where does that come from, and why is that so unsettling?
Where? Oh, that's got to be from Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I was thinking of like the trope where it's like, I'm the real me. Kill him.
Ah, yes, that's a great one. Yeah, this doppelganger thing. It's like, are there doppelgangers in like mythology? Because like when we were talking about other films, like where does this come from? And we've said, well, it goes back to like ancient stories, you know? Like there was a lot of that with The Day the Earth Stood Still, where it felt like mythological stuff was happening, especially with Gort. It's like it's the golem, you know.
Gort.
But like that stolen identity, that doppelganger thing, I guess it has some basis in reality. It's like if a person goes crazy or a person's being deceitful, then they're shown to not be who you thought they were, you know. It's like, so there's some real world connotations to that. I guess another version of that would be is like, you grow up with somebody in high school and you're good friends, and then they go off and join some weird cult, and you're like, huh, not sure I want to hang out with Billy anymore. He shaved his head and he only wears togas now.
We have a childhood friend you hung out with, and
well, that's another thing. Childhood to adulthood, people, you know, experience great changes.
Like you had a lot in common, you were great friends, and then you somehow reconnect like more than a decade later, and this person's just like everything you hate.
The other side of the tracks. Oh, there's so many movies, especially in film noir. That feels like a film noir thing where it's like, or what is it? What is it? A River Runs Through It? Isn't the whole plot of that? It's like two brothers, but they end up being very different people. Oh, never mind. But you know what I'm talking about.
Sure, yeah. I get it.
Yeah, that whole changing identities. It's like the establishment of our social reality is based on people being who we expect them to be, kind of, you know? And when that changes, it can be a little reality-shaking or unnerving.
Like maybe dealing with like a relative going through some memory related disease,
dementia or Alzheimer's,
losing him a bit at a time.
All of a sudden, grandpa's putting the cat into the refrigerator. Hell, you don't even have to have some great life change to have this moment. If you've ever been up in the middle of the night in your house and run into a family member who you didn't know was up, awesome.
Or you wake up and you must have been in like a deeper sleep cycle or something, and you wake up and your brain just isn't like sentient at all. and nothing is familiar, you're like, where the fuck am I? Or you don't know like how things work. Like there's been so many times where my alarm's gone off and I'm totally trying to turn it off the wrong way. So like I keep trying to
just these disorientation. And speaking of dream logic, this film has a whole sequence that feels dreamlike. When he walks out into the desert and he sees his girlfriend, and we know it's the alien because she's wearing the sexy black dress. But she's just standing there, just like on this hill, and he just starts following her and chasing her through this desert terrain. And it feels like, I was watching that and going like, this feels like a dream, you know? This feels like a dream sequence. I don't know if that was intentional or not.
Given the rest of the film, there might be something to that.
I mean, she is an illusion that he's chasing in the desert. So it's like, it's not that much of a stretch. All of a sudden, I thought I was watching a French film.
I don't care. I do what I want.
There is an Italian film, actually, that I saw where it was, I cannot remember the name of it. It's a Criterion release where this group goes to this island and the guy's fiance just disappears. And the best friend and the fiance are trying to like find this woman who disappeared. It's like no one can find her, you know. And that dream sequence kind of reminded me of that film.
Is there a scene like that in the film?
Well, they're on this like, I say it's an island, but imagine it's just like a big one, like this mountainous thing sticking out of the ocean, right?
Right.
It's just really rocky. It's not like there's a beach and trees. It's just like really rocky. So yeah, with the desert terrain being similar, it's like this girl running off and disappearing and this guy chasing is an illusion of his girlfriend through the desert. You know, there were similarities. Obviously, this is a film worth watching because we got a lot out of talking about it.
It's nice hitting this after the dud that we hit last episode.
Oh, absolutely. And this film had a lot of influences. Specifically, Spielberg said that Close Encounters of the Third Kind was basically a tribute to this film. I even read of an interaction where Ray Bradbury was at the premiere of Close Encounters from the Third Kind, and Spielberg came up to him afterwards and said, "How do you like your movie?" And Ray Bradbury was like, "My movie." And Spielberg was saying, "Yeah, this movie wouldn't exist if I didn't see It Came from Outer Space 6 times in the theater when I was a kid."
I can see it. Yeah, it's a hell of a lot more mystery to Spielberg's.
Yeah, but it's the same. It's almost the same kind of mystery. Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounter and the astronomer are going through a lot of the same things.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, one of them. He's trying to convince people the other guy is kind of getting like taken over almost. He's compelled.
Dreyfuss's character, yeah, he's getting these subconscious signals, right?
Yeah.
But we got there from talking about It Came from Outer Space, how this thing can happen where people are suddenly acting different and like a family member going insane, which is what Richard Dreyfuss' character looks like, which is why his wife takes the kids and leaves as he starts to like tear their house apart to build this mountainous shape. You know, it's like we got there from talking about It Came from Outer Space. So yeah, this is totally worth watching this movie. Another interesting thing, it's got that theremin score.
I imagine at the time it was probably a lot creepier than it is now, because it's kind of like a joke sound effect. So it was a little hard to take as seriously these days.
I was able to suspend my disbelief, but the music was actually done by Henry Mancini. Now, do you recognize that name?
No.
But do you recognize this? Dun 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 dun.
Really?
Yeah, he wrote the Pink Panther theme.
Okay.
A really famous composer, or at least he did a lot of prominent work. His work is famous.
Not famous enough.
Internet famous?
Okay.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed this film. And yeah, what a breath of fresh air after the dud of, like, we were hitting good. It's like Day of the Earth Stood Still, good movie. War of the Worlds, really cool. Day the Earth Stood Still. God, that was such.
Wait, hold on. What?
Day the Earth Stood Still is just a dive bomb.
You want to say that again?
I said Earth versus the Flying Saucer. That's what I meant.
Twice, Dave. Are you Dave? Am I talking to Dave?
Look, we've had this conversation. We can't remember the titles of these movies because they all sound the same. We both kept forgetting the title of this movie because It Came from Outer Space. It's just such a generic sounding title. It could be the title to so many different movies.
The Planet of the Alien Visitors.
There's also It Came from Beneath the Sea, It the Terror from Beyond Space, and how many movies have the From Outer Space line in them?
Or Another World.
From Another World. Yeah, The Thing from Another World. These titles are so generic.
Planet, okay,
so,
yeah.
So yeah, Day of the Earth is still great. War of the Worlds, great. Earth versus the Flying Saucers. And then this, which it stands out because this is not an alien invasion movie.
No, the aliens want to go home.
Right. Like we said, the aliens are completely neutral.
It's an so ET it's, scenario.
Yeah. I mean, even the Day the Earth Stood Still, he's a harbinger of a invasion, potentially.
He wants them to show him what they got.
Show me what you got. I'm amazed that we don't reference Rick and Morty way more often on this show.
It's probably because the show has become too referenced.
Yeah, it might be cliche to reference the show at this point. Anyways, so this is our fourth episode in on covering classic sci-fi films. And we focus specifically on alien films. We're going to diverge from that next. But we've watched four alien films from the 50s.
Where are we going now, Dave?
Well, at first I was going to say, which one stands out is the one that impressed you the most?
Ooh. Let's see. I think my favorite of the four here we've watched is War of the Worlds. Day of the Earth Stood Still, I think, kind of was more or less what I expected, but it was still enjoyable. I was surprised at how bad Earth versus the Flying Saucers was.
Yeah, Earth versus the Flying Saucer was still surprising.
And this was kind of like, I wouldn't say surprising, but like, I was maybe expecting a little more generic sci-fi, maybe, but it definitely tugged on character development instead of sci-fi mumbo jumbo.
I would say probably the one of the four I'm going to watch go back to the most is War of the Worlds.
Yes, but I think I would watch this again if somebody wanted to see it. Like, this is a movie that I would go back to reference for movies or whatever I'm making, too.
Yeah, I felt much more inspired by this. And where?
Yeah, me too.
It's hard because, like, I'd seen The Day the Earth Stood Still before, and I'd seen War of the Worlds before. This movie I hadn't seen before.
I hadn't seen any of these.
Yeah, you hadn't seen any of these. But I was really impressed by this movie as a first-time viewer. And seeing how it's kind of, like, between something like The Day the Earth Stood Still and Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yes. Yes.
And I wasn't expecting that. Ultimately, my favorite of all these is probably still War of the Worlds, but It Came from Outer Space, because it's fresher to me, is the one I want to go back to the most right now and rewatch.
Mm-hmm. Watching these films, three out of the four, I have been happy to have enjoyed the three we've highlighted, given that most of the quote-unquote classic sci-fi we've watched have either been hilariously bad, which has its own fun, but still to a certain disappointment, or just most often so boring.
Yeah, I really want to curb your opinion of classic sci-fi by the end of 2018.
It's kind of like, you know, when you introduced me to the classic horror stuff, like Frankenstein.
Especially Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
And I haven't even shown you the Val Lewton stuff, man. It's like I've shown you a good rifle collection, but now I've got to tell you, I've got a bomb in the basement. Oh, yeah, I've got a warhead in the basement.
Looking forward to it, Dave.
Oh, yeah. There's so much more to look forward to. And I do like how these four movies do sort of paint a picture. They're certainly not the only alien movies that came out of the 50s, but they do sort of paint a picture of this time in the 50s where it was like the Cold War was happening, but also we were starting to talk about going into space and going to the moon a little bit. It's like we're talking about building rockets and launching satellites, and you know, we hadn't gotten to Sputnik quite yet, but it was in the popular consciousness along with things like the Red Scare, you know, along with things like nuclear annihilation.
Nuclear.
And that the culture was sort of absorbing these things, and this was what came out of the culture sort of absorbing that information. And because of its setting, It Came from Outer Space, I think hits that point a little better. It's a hit because it's seeing that small town America feeling, because you really get a sense of like the people living in this town, you know, and them reacting to this thing that they don't know how to deal with, you know, that's part of something larger. It's like that really hits home more to like the feeling of like the American would be having at the time in the culture, you know, where it's like you're just living in the small town, but there's this big thing you don't know what to do about. I mean, you can feel that right now. It's like, go out today, you know, that's what this feels like, you know, where it's like there's this looming presence of the time that you're living in, you know, but there's also like this, you're just going out into your town and living your life. So, and that's a hell of a thing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Know Your Turns at the Drive-In. We've been your hosts, Luke and
Arian Dave.
If you enjoyed what you listened to, may I suggest you go to our website at cyclejellyfish.com to find this and other podcasts. You can also subscribe to us on any podcast app that pretty much fits your style. We're probably there. Thoughts, words, comments, or questions, please tell us what you thought of this film.
Good night, gentle listeners.
Keep it psycho.
We were just discussing when does the classic science fiction film end and the modern science fiction film begin. Right before we got on to record, we were having that conversation. And I feel that Star Wars is the first modern science fiction film, and anything before Star Wars is classic, including 2001: A Space Odyssey. So, like, that's where I draw a hard line.
Sure, I think I could agree with that. I don't really have any objections to it. It's just when you put that firm line down, you're gonna have detractors.
Oh, I know there's detractors. For me, that's the firm line. So, like, that's my personal guideline. I'm not going to like impose that on anyone else. Like, when you think of classic science fiction films, like, what comes to your mind immediately?
Slower, usually black and white. Maybe effects feel cheaper most of the time. Not all the time. Over-the-top acting.
Like Shatner?
Yeah. or that lady from War of the Worlds.
Well, it's like, all genres have this discussion, right? Like film noir, some people feel if it's not black and white, it's not film noir.
I don't fully buy that, but
I don't buy it either. As the czar of noir, Eddie Muller, said on one of his Q&As, he said, you know, is it the lighting and art direction? Is it the costumes or the time period? Or is it the story, you know?
Yeah.
And we've also had this discussion about Westerns, about where does the classic Western end and where does the, you know, revision of the Western begin.
What do you mean by revision?
Like, there is a stark difference between, say, the Spaghetti Western, the Man with No Name trilogy, and that, and the Westerns that were coming out in the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Mm, okay. Okay. Because it's almost like one long train to me, and that eventually ended, and then you just get kind of like people throwing more cabooses onto it during modern day.
Yeah, because there's like, they just came out with a Western series for Netflix. And then you've got Westworld,
yep.
Which is a sci-fi Western, but it has those Western aesthetics in there.
I think it's losing a lot of those this next season, but yeah.
Then, like, Tarantino had The Hateful Eight, which is its own, like, taking heavily from the spaghetti Western, but also largely from horror movies. And also, just because it's a Tarantino film, it's just like in a genre of its own.